The World Cup will be played again this year. It's in the same year as the Winter Olympics, so only every 4 years a new champion is crowned for the whole world, not like baseball's World Series, world in quotes. 1 billion people watched the last World Cup final in 2014. By comparison, the last Super Bowl audience was about a tenth that big. Why does the world love soccer so much, and we feel not only kind of lukewarm about it, but don't even call it by the name the rest of the world uses? Football. There's plenty of analysis and a good starter set of things to know in the new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. It is the work of Laurent Dubois, who teaches at Duke University, where he's a professor of romance studies and history. One of his most popular courses is called Soccer Politics. Laurent is the author of 5 books, including Soccer Empire. Welcome, Laurent Dubois.
Thanks for having me today.
So you begin as a fan, don't you? A rather large fan, I would think.
Yeah, definitely. I've got an interest in soccer as a fan, and then I've also just, through teaching and reading about it, become fascinated by its reach around the world and all the things it kind of illuminates or teaches us about lots of different cultures and places as well.
We already told our listeners at the top of the hour that you're a rabid fan of the French national team, having grown up in France, but do you have a favorite pro team as well?
I have a few that I follow. I enjoy following the English Premier League. I enjoy following big teams in Spain. But I have to admit, I'm kind of more of a follower of players often than of particular teams. So there's not one that I've kind of devoted my heart to.
Who are the players you like the best?
I really enjoy seeing like Paul Pogba right now, a number of the French and Belgian players that I'm kind of eager to see their professional form, because then that helps to see what the international game is going to be. Locally, I've actually been going for the last year since they moved here to the Carolina Courage, which is our National Women's Soccer League team, and they're wonderful, and that probably the local fan, that's the one that I'm most interested in.
NWSL, okay, yeah, in addition to the male soccer league as well.
Mm-hmm.
Curious about that course that you teach in soccer politics. What kinds of subjects are within that?
Well, we really use it as a way to think pretty broadly about what the sport can teach us about culture and history in lots of different locations. So I begin with this basic puzzle about why this game has spread all over the world, basically how it's kind of anchored and indigenous in so many different societies, and what that tells us about the game, about being human, and about these different places. We look at Latin America, at Africa, at Europe, the links between soccer and politics in all of those places. You know, the place of soccer and decolonization in Africa, questions around immigration in Europe. And then we look a lot at the questions of kind of gender in sport as well, both in the United States and abroad.
And I want to disabuse anybody of the notion that this is just sort of a how to understand soccer book. I mean, yeah, there are some steps to take to understand the various positions on the field and even the referee and all that. But there are lots of great stories in here as well. And in fact, there's one where you mentioned the film Timbuktu and a set of circumstances there. It was just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is for me one of the most beautiful sequences I've seen in film. It's Abderrahmane Sissoko's film, essentially a kind of parable in a way about an Islamist takeover of the town of a town in West Africa. But there's a moment where they decide to ban soccer and they take away the soccer balls and seeing it as kind of against religious precepts, strangely in a way. But there's a scene where basically the boys play a whole game. They can play a whole game without a ball because the game is so familiar that you can essentially enact it even if you don't have a ball. And kind of as a reminder that, as I say in the book, that soccer is kind of an idea above all.
So I mean, lots of theories, I'm sure, about this, but I want to hear yours about why this sport went worldwide and not baseball or cricket or basketball, at least to the same level.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots of different layers to that. I think, of course, it's a relatively simple game. It requires basically a ball and not much other infrastructure. Goals are easy to set up. It is a game also that it welcomes a lot of different body types. There really isn't one size or really that you need to be to play. You can have a lot of short players, taller players. So there's a kind of democratic nature to it in that sense. And then a little bit on a bigger scale, just sort of symbolically and culturally, I think that it provides a really amazing kind of spectrum of emotions and stories that people are able to kind of connect to their own lives. So there's a way in which each of these games becomes an interesting drama that has elements that just make it this really riveting theater and spectacle and something people love to watch but also love to talk about and talk about in, you know, in all different languages and all different places. So I think that latter capacity is probably what explains its kind of status as this, again, this the most popular sport on the planet and actually in some ways one of the most widely shared forms of culture, period, that we have.
Oh, that's true. We can all get together and appreciate a soccer game together. At least most parts of the world can. And I might have to admit, the book did get me thinking more deeply what appeals to me about soccer. I do like watching the World Cup in particular, but you know, often scoring, things like those are surprises. It's not like in baseball or football when a team is close to scoring. It just sort of happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the unpredictability, and we see this all the time. I saw this yesterday in Champions League's game where there was this huge upset. That basically it's very hard to go into a game with any certainty of what will happen, and there's so many unpredictable things about it, in part because the game is so low scoring. So this is something that obviously some who don't like the sport complain about, compared obviously to basketball or football, where there's kind of points, you know, happening regularly. There are games in soccer that are 0-0, and there's even some pretty amazing games that end 0-0. So the goals are vital, but there's so much else in the sport, and the kind of irregularity of the goals, I think, is part of the drama. Because often games turn out a way that doesn't feel like they're right, you know. In that sense, I think there's this kind of way in which the sport reflects people's experiences of life, not only in terms of occasionally winning, but also the frustrations and just unpredictability of things.
Great stories of contemporary soccer, great stories of soccer in history, and I'm going to call it football a little more often as we go through the hour. Laurent Dubois is our guest on The Exchange. His book is called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. We'll return to him in about 2 minutes. Right now, let me remind you, it's the last day of Spring Fund Drive here on JPR. So we're trying to get to $200,000 and 400 new members by just before 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to have to make a real bold run at it, and we're doing really well so far this morning. Lots of people calling in pledges of support, including Frank and Gudrun Gill in Medford, Lucy Dobson in Ashland, Marissa Peterson in Phoenix, Gary Bryans in Eureka, and Joyce Epstein in Ashland. Thank you all for your pledges of support. We'll take yours as well, please. 888-552-6191 by phone. Online, it's ijpr.org. Thank you, and we'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about football today, the game the world knows as football, not our version, in which you're actually not allowed to actually use your feet on the American football in some cases. There's rules there that we could get into, but probably won't. Laurent Dubois, who teaches at Duke University, professor of romance studies and history, is the author of a book called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. So he makes a concession to the American name for football, but then gives us a whole lot of history and a lot of understanding of the game and some of its really great moments as we get closer to this year's World Cup. So lots of big football events coming up in the world this year. We can talk about football with you right here, right now on the Jefferson Exchange with you and Laurent Dubois. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's go back to the origin stories. Where did soccer come from?
Well, its deep origins lie in a number of different games that were played, kind of folk games that were played throughout England and other parts of the United Kingdom, going back actually to the Middle Ages. And there's other forms of ball games in Italy and all over the world. But the modern form of the game kind of took shape through the schools, the universities and public schools and schools in England in the beginning of the 19th century, when they basically started trying to have these games. They wanted to play against one another. Different rules made that complicated. So by 1863, a group of people come together and kind of put together a rule book, the laws of the game, they call them. And those rules, interestingly, are basically the shape of the game to this day. There's obviously been some important modifications, but most of those were done in the late 19th century. So it's a sport that's been remarkably stable in its rules, something which kind of contrasts a little bit with some of our sports here, that where the rules have changed a lot more in the 20th century.
I know, the NFL is still trying to figure out when you catch a ball and when you don't.
Right, absolutely. And, I mean, interestingly for Americans, the sport of football, American football, actually emerges from a kind of mix of rugby and soccer codes, but it actually shares origins with soccer, which is a bit hard for people to fathom today, but this is part of the same family. These are kind of cousins in a way, but they've gone in very different directions, and the big changes in American football happen basically in the Ivy League universities in the late 19th century, and probably the biggest of all was moving to marking the field and kind of measuring movement in a way that really defines American football and doesn't define soccer really at all. So that's one of the big contrasts, but it's interesting to think that these sports actually have a common root.
It truly is. Yeah, the gridiron is what you're talking about there, that we measure the whole, 10 yards and you get a first down thing. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, not much change in the basic rules of football, the world football, since 1863, but there is a variant. Tell us about anarchist football.
Oh, yes. I love discovering this, that at one point in the 1960s, a sort of an artist and with kind of left political leanings basically thought, why do we have this sport where it's always, two teams against each other? That's kind of anchoring everything as a conflict between two. So he created a sport with three sides. Same idea. You've got goals, you've got a ball, but there's three teams. And the game is to not have goals scored against you. So it actually profits you to collaborate with another team. You can kind of unite with another team and create collaboration. And there's no referee, so it's all about kind of these alliances. And the idea is to kind of break down this idea that, it's always one against another, and to celebrate different forms of connection and collaboration. And there's actually leagues that play this game in the United States now as well.
Really? Okay, I have to keep an eye out for that. I'm just curious if you've had a chance to really get into not just the American relationship to soccer as a sport to watch, but the fact that it seems like so many kids play it. I mean, there have been elections when we talked about we had to, the party and had to focus on the soccer moms to be able to win, but people seem to drift away from the game as they get older.
Well, I actually think it's the game that's played the most in the United States recreationally. I think that's probably the sport that's most popular in that sense, just because of all the leagues and in part because you've got girls and women playing in really, really large numbers. So that's really important. It's true that the kind of media landscape suggests something very different, right? So there's this disjuncture between what people kind of experience in their daily life and then what they're watching on TV and what the college sports are. It's obviously slowly changing, but it's pretty remarkable how slow it has been. And there's the people who kind of suggested at various points of the last decades that soccer is, on the cusp of making it often turn out to be wrong. I mean, making it in the kind of the sense of competing with, say, basketball or football. Eduardo Galeano, who's a Uruguayan writer who wrote a fabulous book on soccer called Soccer and Sun and Shadow that I use a lot in the book, has a quip where he says, in the United States, soccer is the sport of the future and always will be. And there's this kind of sense. So I guess, but I do ask the question at the beginning of the book, which is, maybe that's okay, right? Maybe the fact that soccer is the kind of culture it is in the United States is good. I mean, it's an alternative for people to some of the dominant sports culture, which has obviously many of its big problems too. So, there's always a sense that it's supposed to grow, but I would also sort of say, well, maybe it's fine as it is, or maybe what it does in this culture is good in the role that it presents an alternative.
Laurent, are you encouraged by the U.S. pro teams with big followings like the Portland Timbers and Portland Thorns? And it sounds like the Carolina Courage brings some people out too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I love going to the Carolina Courage games. This is a team that just moved here a year ago, but there was clearly a kind of hunger for women's soccer here. And the stadium's not a massive stadium, but it's got 6,000, 8,000 people for each game. Really great atmosphere, lots of kids watching. So I think there's lots of grassroots soccer scenes. And obviously in Portland and Seattle, there's an amazing group. But in Atlanta, the MLS team, which is relatively new, has a huge following already. So I actually think there's kind of a lot to tap into. And it's also true that this is, in the United States, you can watch maybe more soccer on TV than you can in most other countries in the world. People are watching the Champions League. I teach my class, and, I get lots of students at Duke who are really, really deep into soccer. Some of them, have come from abroad, but many of them grow up in the United States and have embraced it. So it's a pretty solid and intense world of soccer fans here. Just I don't think quite gets the same kind of media attention that other sports do.
Laurent Dubois is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about the game the world knows as football is called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. I want to talk about a particular incident, though. I knew there was a football game in Paris the night of the attacks in November of 2015, but I didn't realize the details about people staying in the park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is, again, those terrible attacks across the city, but one of the targets was the soccer stadium where there was a game going on, a pretty big game, actually, sort of France-Germany, a friendly match, as they call them, but major two teams. President of France was in attendance, so some of the terrorists wanted to basically go in and bomb within the stadium, and they weren't able to. They were stopped and discovered before going in, so that attack was foiled because of security. But when it happened, there was a concern about what to do with this, tens of thousands of people in the stadium. So, and interestingly, you know, in a stadium, you often can't get good reception on your phone because so many people are there in one packed location. So people didn't really know what was going on, weren't aware that there had been an attempted attack, and were kept in the stadium, eventually found out what was going on, but were asked to stay there and then eventually brought out because they weren't sure what would happen. But it was a very powerful moment, too, because that stadium was built in 1998. It's where France won the World Cup in 1998. It's been the site of all kinds of, you know, kind of legendary events and political moments in French history. So I tell that story in the early version, in the early part of the book, to just kind of emphasize all the layers of the sport and its links to politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And after the introduction, the book does go position by position. And we start with the goalies. What does a good goalkeeper require?
Well, the goalie, I think, is maybe the most fascinating position just because it's an outlier, right? Most players can't use their hands. The goalie can. The goalie kind of doesn't move as much as other players because they're mostly supposed to stay in the penalty box. The penalty box is a very big area already because the soccer field is huge. But the goalie, I think, has obviously a physical goal, a physical role to sort of stop the ball, but also is a really important as a psychological force. I think powerful personalities are important for goalies because they give confidence and they position their defenders in front of them. And when a goalie kind of exudes that confidence, it kind of enables the team not only to defend well, but to kind of move forward. So the goalie is supposed to stop the goals, but also to kind of launch the attack in a lot of soccer games as well. But it's a lonely position, and it's a position that is one where, you know, you're blamed for goals that might not exactly be your fault. They might be your defender's fault. But as the last line of defense, so a lot of times the kind of anger of fans falls on the goalie in a way that can be pretty harsh. So it's a place for strong personalities who can stand up to that.
And there's one particular story that you tell about Lev Yashin of Russia. This is a person who apparently went from hero to goat to hero to goat to hero to goat.
Exactly, right? He would be the great hero because of save, and then the next time it would be entirely his fault that Russia had lost the World Cup. And I mean, I tell a famous story from Brazil of a goalie who was for decades was blamed for a loss in the Brazil World Cup. I mean, they really can be blamed. But I make the link. I talk about Albert Camus, who's a, you know, kind of key writer and existentialist philosopher, and was also a goalie. And there is a way in which I think one has to be quite philosophical to be in that role.
I never thought of Camus as a goalie. Mm-hmm. He always seems more like a striker to me. But
there are others. France Fanon was a striker. when we go through intellectuals and soccer positions, but.
Excellent. There's another story about the loneliness of the goalie about a Christmas game between Charlton and Chelsea in 1937.
Yeah, I mean, this story I loved when I read about it in a book by Jonathan Wilson about a history of the goalkeeper. Basically, a fog comes down on the pitch. It's 1938, and the fog comes down so intensely and so deeply that they have to cancel the game, and the fans leave, and all the players walk off, except nobody bothers to tell the goalie for Charlton Athletic. So he's sitting there in the fog, and he keeps thinking to himself, wow, we're doing really well. You know, we must be attacking the other goal, but we're not scoring, because otherwise they would come back to the halfway line, and I would see someone. And eventually a policeman comes out of the fog and says, you know, what on earth are you doing here? And he kind of has to go back to the changing room, and everybody's kind of laughing at him. But I kind of suggest that there's something to that story, right, that goalies might often wonder that as they're looking at the fog of the game. And, you know, I played goalie as a kid and remember this vividly, that you're sort of back and far away, and then you kind of see things unfold and approach and have to be ready. But it is an interesting spot to start from, to be in. And I think maybe the key part, obviously, to start from to understand what happens in all the other positions.
Truly. There was an interesting point here, though. You pointed there was a change in goalie rules just in 1990.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty significant change. What would happen is that in one of the tournaments that year, someone would pass back to the goalie, and the goalie would just kind of pick it up and hold the ball for a long time if they wanted to waste time, and it made for some pretty boring moments in the game. So they changed a rule, adding essentially when you pass back, if your own player passes back to the goalie can't pick it up with their hands. So that changes things, because if you pass it back, the goalie can receive it with their feet, but they're kind of like any other player. They can't use the hands. And that means that you've got to be careful about that, because the goalies have to be better with their feet. And it changes the dynamism and kind of makes it a bit more dynamic. So that was a significant rule change recently.
I didn't realize that somebody had actually held the ball for six entire minutes. That seems
exactly
a little excessive.
Right. Someone said, okay, that's a little much. So, I mean, they are tinkering with the rules kind of constantly, but it's interesting that the basic structure hasn't changed that much. But that was a significant one in 1994. For sure.
We are talking about football as the world knows it with Laurent Dubois, who's a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University. born and raised in France, so a big fan of the national team. He'll get to watch the national team in this year's World Cup. He's put a book out just in time for us to help understand the game a little better called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer, with lots of great stories and good histories. And you can join the conversation on the exchange, share your favorite football or soccer story, depending on where in the world you're from originally. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Laurent, move us up to the next line, the defender. I mean, they don't make most of the goals, obviously, but these are really important players on the field.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously very central. And the role of the defender, I mean, obviously, is to kind of protect the goal, but also their role is to kind of turn the game around. In other words, to sort of stop the attack play of the other team and then flip it back into an offensive play. So I think I write about other great defenders. They're certainly not as prominent or visible as goal scorers. And yet, if you know, they're really so central to the architecture of the team. And that's the chapter where I explain something that mystifies, you know, many a soccer parent in the United States and many who watch the game, which is the offside rule, which I argue is kind of the basic core, maybe, architecture of the game. But it really, really shapes how the game is played, and defenders obviously use that rule as part of what they do. So I felt like explaining that was going to be very helpful for those who are trying to get into understanding the game, and even those who watch the game, but knowing the history of it kind of helps understand why that rule is what it is.
So when you're off your defensive side of the field, into the opponent's zone there, you can't be beyond the last defensive player, just parked there waiting for a ball. And it's kind of like you're not allowed to park in the key in basketball. You can't get mm-hmm. that. Yeah, you can't get, you know, positioned there waiting to take a pass.
Exactly. I mean, what it prevents is just having an offensive player stand in front of the goal and wait for someone to lob the ball to them. And right. So what it does instead is, because basically the defenders gives the power to defenders to position themselves on the field, because if the defenders are at a certain place, the offensive players can't go past them. Well, they can go past them, but then they can't receive a ball. So what it does, though, it's a very complicated rule to enforce, because it depends on when the ball is kicked, and you can move kind of once the ball's in motion. So the intricacy of those calls are very difficult. You know, they're very difficult to make, and the referees are often kind of, people argue about whether they made the right call. But what it does enable is for a kind of flow. I did a sort of clinic with my students on the quad at Duke about this, and it's just really interesting, because without even touching the ball, a defender can kind of reshape what the offensive team can do, and that's been, you know, one of the key tactical areas for developing soccer tactics.
And in fact, defenders still, to some extent, use offside traps, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you can move ahead at right, you can basically trap the offensive players on the wrong side, basically, by suddenly moving ahead and keeping them in the wrong position. It's a little dangerous, because if you mess it up, then the offensive player might have the ball and have a kind of clear line towards goal. But it is a kind of key part of keeping it. And if you, what you'll sometimes hear people say, playing a high line. So if you have the defenders very far up the field, what it does is it kind of eliminates a whole section of the field from the other team in a way, and then kind of presses them in their own half and creates a different kind of context where you have a better chance of attacking. So I think, you know, once you get that, it kind of becomes really interesting to watch, because you can really watch that part of how the teams are playing. It's easier to understand if you're watching in a stadium, because it's often movement that's happening far away from the ball, but it's shaping everything else that happens on the field.
So let me understand again. So with the way the rule is now, you can actually move before the ball. You can actually get ahead of the ball and the defender as long as the ball is coming your way?
Exactly, yeah. So it's about that, which is why some people, you know, the referee has to have eyes that go in two directions. But you kind of need to understand the timing in two places at once. And that's so that there's a kind of dynamism to the play. In other words, you can set up a play. What you can't do is sort of hang out way ahead of the defenders. But in the dynamism of play, you can begin to move just as the ball's kind of coming towards you, so that you can kind of catch it on the other side.
Okay, so sort of like a forward pass in American football.
Yeah.
It was a defender who, you point out, put France in the World Cup final in 1998. This is a great story about a defender.
Yeah, Lilian Thuram, who's one of my great heroes in the sport, and an earlier book I wrote called Soccer Empire focuses on him and Zinedine Zidane. Thuram has also been a major kind of political voice and activist on behalf of kind of marginalized communities in France. And but he was, you know, a pretty young player in 1998, a defensive player, basically let in a goal, or kind of allowed a goal to happen by the Croatians in a kind of critical match, the semifinal match. because he failed to, he basically positioned himself wrong vis-a-vis offside. So he kind of enabled the player to kind of cut through and score. And I think, you know, realizing he'd made a mistake, he basically almost instantly went and streaked forward and scored a goal in response, which was completely unlike him. He was more well known for scoring own goals, you know, where a defender kicks it. And that just wasn't what he did, you know. And then later in the game, he scored a second goal, kind of an amazing kind of goal, after which he kneeled on the pitch, kind of put his hand over his, you know, his hand over his mouth in a kind of thoughtful thinker pose, which became this iconic image of him. And he's a very intelligent, intellectual guy who's now written, you know, books and done other work after retiring. But Thuram was really interesting because those are the only two goals he ever scored for the French team, although he played 142 games for them. But those two moments in his life kind of made him a global icon, really. I mean, I brought him to Duke University in 2009. I wasn't quite sure, you know, if people would know who he was, but we had massive, you know, crowds and people very familiar with him. I mean, soccer figures are kind of, you know, basically some of the best known people on the planet, and they're kind of legends circulate in these really interesting ways. So that one moment in his life, as he recognizes, sort of transformed everything, and as far as he sees it, gave him a kind of responsibility to use that iconic status for good projects.
Well, more stories of some of the greats in the game of football as the world knows it, soccer as we know it, with Laurent Dubois and his book, The Language of the Game. We are at, in our fund drive, final day, nearly $134,000, trying to raise $200,000 by the time the day is through, and need your support at 888-552-6191 and at ijpr.org. Want to thank Charles Moresi in Klamath Falls, Rick Stein in Grants Pass, Bruce and Leslie Sargent in Ashland, Carol Lipman in Ashland, and Peter DeAndres in Eureka. 888-552-6191 and ijpr.org. Thanks so much. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are heading toward the World Cup in the game the world knows as football later this year, a chance to crown a new champion for the next 4 years. Laurent Dubois gets ahead of the curve by teaching us a bit more about the game and some of its significant moments, both back to its origins and in the way it is played in the world today. The book is called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer, and it really does start with the goalkeeper, moves on to a chapter on defender, the midfielder, the forward, the manager, the referee, and, of course, the fan. Lots to talk about here. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the significance of the game of football the world over. 1 billion people will probably watch the World Cup final this year if the numbers are equal to what happened 4 years ago. That's nearly 10 times the audience for the Super Bowl. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Before we get to the scorers up front, we have to pause with midfielders. These I don't know, when you think about middle, sort of middle of the road kinds of things, are these often the forgotten people of football?
Sometimes they are, although some of them, especially the more attacking-minded midfielders, do become very famous. Zidane was a midfielder, for instance. But at the same time, they're actually really pivotal to the game. I mean, they're kind of the playmakers. They are the ones who kind of distribute the ball and can control what happens in much of the rest of the field. And so I loved writing that chapter because it's some of the, you know, really the most vital players in the history of the game have been in that position. It's kind of a crucial one to understand, and maybe one of the more creative and interesting ones to understand as well.
You just mentioned Zidane, which would be Zinedine Zidane, who is famous for leading France to a World Cup triumph in 98, but then headbutting someone in the chest, getting ejected from a game. Was it the next World Cup after that?
It was two World Cups later. It was in 2006.
Mm-hmm. And so, what's your overall impression of the legacy of Zinedine Zidane now?
Well, Zidane now, and now he's actually the coach for Real Madrid, a team where he played professionally. So he's now kind of having a quite successful career as a coach, actually. I think he's a kind of incredibly fascinating figure at both of those moments, both him winning with two headers, actually, in 1998. He's of Algerian descent, you know, a group that is at the center of a lot of politics and kind of debates about migration and Islam in France. So his iconic status was connected to kind of the fact of his background. Meant that he became a symbol for kind of a hope for a different kind of future of France. He wasn't as outspoken as Thuram, but nevertheless played that role. And then his headbutt in 2006 was actually one of the first great kind of memes to emerge in our kind of modern social media world. Because it was so fascinating to people. This was his last gesture, actually, ever in his career as a football player on the field in the World Cup final, a kind of gesture of violence, but that he explained was a response to verbal insults. And it made him, in a way, even more iconic because I think people were so fascinated with it, and there was such a huge conversation about it. So there are these moments in soccer that are kind of moments of transgression or moments when people break the rules that are sometimes some of the most fascinating moments, the moments people remember the most in the game.
We have an email here from Mike in Medford. He says, while living in Lyon, France for a few years during my early 20s, I would always hear a really loud stadium pretty far from my apartment. After returning to the U.S., I really got into soccer and realized I lived just down the street from Olympic Lyonnais. Oh, well, next time, says Mike in Medford.
Right. No, absolutely. I think, he was close to a very legendary stadium. So, and I think I know a friend of mine who lived in Algeria and works on Algeria for a while told me recently, she was not into the sport. And then every weekend she would just think, what is that noise? What is going on? Why are people in the streets? And, there's this, I show students often just footage of, when a country qualifies for the World Cup in most of the world, it's days of celebrations, right? Sort of celebrations, the likes of which that many people have never seen, so the kind of importance of this sport, I think, is that comment kind of brings it home.
So let's talk about what the World Cup means, though, because France is heading for it, isn't it? It's in the mm-hmm. world. Okay, but the United States is not.
The United States did fail to qualify, which was kind of a shocker. They've been qualifying regularly for a while. And I think in the United States there's a sort of confusion about it because we compete in a confederation called CONCACAF where we have Mexico, which is a major rival in Canada, but then basically lots of other smaller countries in Central America and the Caribbean, a number of which beat us out to get into the World Cup, including Panama and Costa Rica. So there's a kind of question in the United States, why are we not better at soccer when we're such a, so good at these other sports and so forth. So it is kind of creating a lot of soul searching and created a lot of kind of upended a little bit the political world of the Fox Soccer Federation. On the other side, of course, the women's team has won 3 World Cups, is a really huge champion and has a really, really global reputation. So the women's team will almost certainly be in the 2019 Women's World Cup, which will be played in France next year. And the largest viewing audiences for soccer games in the United States have actually been for women's World Cups. The largest was in 2015 for the Women's World Cup final. So that's kind of interesting in its own way and raises, other questions as well.
It really is, and you're very fair in the book. You mentioned right in the introduction that it's a very sexist sport, that women have been held down in the sport for a long time in a lot of ways. You do give some great examples, though. In fact, in the chapter we were just talking about on midfielders, mm-hmm. you give Carly Lloyd credit for one of the most amazing midfielder moves ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was in the 2015 final, actually. This is, again, this most-watched soccer game versus Japan in 2015. And she scored from the midfield, which is this kind of thing that occasionally midfielders do, rather than having to work their way all the way up across the pitch. And she just kind of looked up and noticed, Zidane actually did this once as well, noticed that the goalie was just a little bit far off the line, a little bit far up, and that she had this shot. It turns out it was something that she had long practiced as just kind of a fun part of her game. But there was just something riveting and beautiful and crazy about it, because it's really not something you don't really want to try it and fail, because it looks a little ridiculous. But if you try it and succeed, it's just phenomenal. And so, yeah, I do write about her, and she's got a great autobiography, and she defines really well, I think, what it is to be a midfield player.
And I remember that goal. It just took off at midfield and got behind the Japanese goalie, who mm-hmm. got hands on it, as you point out, but didn't get there in time.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's take a call here from Tony in Talent, who is originally from the U.K. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Laurent Dubois.
Yes, and if your gentleman there follows English soccer, then my team is about to join the Premier League, Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Oh, wonderful team. That's exciting. Yes, congratulations.
Well, historically, but not for
that. I'm a really serious fan of that team, an American in my class, and he talks about it constantly. So.
Well, he's very happy this year, of course.
Yes, yeah.
But now I was wondering, coming from Wolverhampton, also was the home of a fellow called Jack Taylor, who refereed the 1974, he was my butcher, actually, would you believe, those were in the days when referees were semi-pro. And he refereed the World Cup final between Germany and Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dutch side was playing, before the World Cup final, was playing this wonderful free-flowing football, Johan Cruyff inspired, mm-hmm. who was their captain. And Jack Taylor gave a penalty for the Germans in the first 2 minutes.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I saw him afterwards and went for some meat, actually, in those days I ate meat. And I said, do you realize that at that particular moment, what with a billion people throughout the world watching, perhaps a little less then, he was probably the most unpopular man in the world.
Yes, I think that may well have been true, and is remembered, too. That was an incredible moment, because the midfield chapter we've been talking about centers a lot on Johan Cruyff, who really kind of transformed the game of soccer with this sort of style called total football that was really remarkable and beautiful and kind of altered how the game was played. But they never won. You know, that team, this extraordinary team of stars, did not win the World Cup in part because of that game and because of that penalty. But referees' decisions, I often point this out. I mean, goals are talked about a lot, but sometimes referees' decisions are talked about even more. And decades later, if you talk to certain Dutch folks, you know, they will remember that as a kind of crucial turning point, kind of in the history of their country, I think. So there are other cases like that, too. But it's really interesting to think about what the big role that the referee has in the game. And I, as much as people lament it, I think it's part of the key to the success of the sport, because talking about that is one of the most, kind of enduring things about fandom.
Tony, thanks for the visit, and best of luck to the Wolverhampton Wanderers as they move up into the Premier League. I do want to get into at least a little bit into the chapter on strikers, and I guess I'll have to finish up by asking again about, because it's in that chapter that you talk about women's football in England during World War I,
mm-hmm.
and the rise and then the crushing fall of it. What happened there?
Well, this is a key point in my book. I mean, soccer, women's soccer is as old as soccer itself. Women have been playing the game since, at least 150 years we know documented. And so I wanted to foreground that history. And one of the forewords I write about is a woman named Lily Parr, who was part of this extraordinary team called the Dirk Kerr Ladies Club that emerged during World War I, but then continued afterwards. Until in 1921, the Football Association of England decided to essentially ban women's soccer from being played on FA pitches and so forth. They obviously couldn't prevent women from playing it in other venues, but they kind of pushed it out of the mainstream with devastating consequences, I think, for the development of the sport and for social, sort of social history as well. That's really was important to me in writing the book, for people to realize that there's a deep, deep history of women's soccer. It's not a new thing. It was simply held back for much of the 20th century. And we're still dealing with the legacies of that now.
Well, the book looks like an explanatory book on soccer, which it is up to a point, but there's a whole lot more romance to it and a clear love for the game that you feel it really comes through, particularly in the histories that you tell. The book is called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. It's the work of Professor Laurent Dubois from Duke University. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.